I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Last Tuesday on What's Next, we aired part one of our conversation with Dr. Henry Louis Taylor Jr. of the UB Center for Urban Studies. We talked about the challenges facing Buffalo's East Side. Today, part two of that conversation, looking ahead to possible solutions.
And so if we're in a community where we don't think that's possible, that there are too many people with too many different ideas about how they want to develop the neighborhood and the community, that might be a neighborhood we would steer away. Or we might say, well, since we got to fight this anyway, perhaps this is a good site, you know, to be able to do it. But it's a place where we think people would agree with the values that drive this process. And we're talking about solidarity, participatory democracy, community control, inclusion and belonging, community wealth production, and being able to control market dynamics. And so the values are important, and I don't know if I meant shared ownership and cooperative economics, because we want to create a community where communal forms and collaborative forms of development become the norm. I mean, you'll still have individual wealth, but individual wealth is one thing. Community wealth is something else.
Right.
Because of the large numbers of African Americans that live alone and their limited resources, we think creating living spaces where you get to share expenses become hugely important in terms of both meeting challenges and developing a control over one's destiny. And so those are the kinds of values that we would want that community to be able to grasp and willing to grasp. We don't think that will be an issue, because all of the things that we're talking about are derived from the lived experiences and the historical experiences of African Americans. And we think that people will see these things, grasp them, and use them as guideposts in the design and the development of their community. And so those are the kinds of elements and things we will be looking for in that site and in that location. And once we get that site and location, the next thing we will begin to do is put together the comprehensive plan and proposal that we will then take to funders.
You also said that you anticipate cooperation from Land Bank and from the city.
Yes.
Is that cooperation there right now?
At a talking level.
Okay.
At a talking level. We're talking about finding ways when we get to that point to cooperate, to collaborate as much as possible. And, you know, we'll see what happens from there. And we're also well aware that at the time that we really launch, there'll be a new administration in City Hall, because we really won't be ready to rock and roll until the beginning of 25.
Is that going to be part of your strategy, is to make sure that that's part of the campaign talk in 2025 from whoever is going to be running for mayor?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a political agenda. Once upon a time, there was this belief that you could ignore City Hall and the political world and do things. That was a fantasy. and it wasn't connected to the real world. So this project will be a part of the talking points, whoever is mayor of the city, just as it's part of the talking points now. And we think that based on all of the conversations that we've had with folks all over the city, we found no opposition to the plan itself. And we understand that structurally, people are locked into things and doing things in another way.
Right.
So we know that the city is locked and the planners are locked into doing this and this. And they deal with the framework, a plan, a project here, a project there, a project there, a project there. And that's not going to change anytime soon. But what we hope to do is to create an environment where the projects, some of the projects you would do, you would be able to do those projects here. From the council part, there's some laws that got to be changed.
Okay.
There's some laws that got to be changed. And there are going to be hard conversations over there. Like vacant lots, we think should be given to the people who live in a community. They are commons. The vacant lots in neighborhood A, that doesn't belong to the city. That belongs to the people who live in the neighborhood and the community. And they should not have to buy anything from the city that they plan to develop. You know, that should be given to them, and the city will reap their rewards from the taxes and from the reduced cost in certain other areas. Because if we're successful, for example, police costs is going down.
Right.
Which means now there will be increasing dollars that you can repurpose elsewhere. If suddenly the East Side is thriving, business, all kinds of things are going to happen on a positive side. Because we would have shown that there's another process and pattern of growing and developing neighborhoods and communities. So we don't want oppositional relationships. We want collaborative relationships. But they're relationships that have to be rooted in the strategic approach to development that we're talking about. And we're talking about moving away from the traditional white model of neighborhood development because it doesn't work for most people. It doesn't even work for most white people.
Right.
You know, it's a wonderful story.
Right.
It's a great story.
You buy a
home. You buy a house.
Yeah.
You accumulate wealth and wealth, and that we throw that word around, which makes most people, I'm going to get lots of money. I'll buy a house for $100,000. I'm going to sell it for $1 million. Then I'll pass that on to my children, and they will be happy. Or I'll pass my house on to the children. They'll either live there or sell it and make a lot of money. That's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful story. But for how many Americans have realized that story? How many black, white, brown, I don't care what color you are, unless you're wealthy. How many people can tell that story? Not a lot. So, and a lot of the advantages that come from owning a home, if you're able to get there, comes from policies that the government created, policies that we could create to do some other types of things. So we believe that when I'm not opposed to home ownership, I own a home. But what I am saying is that a lot of people can't go that route. And for a lot of folks, like my father and mom, they own their home. But I got to tell you, there was no generational wealth. You know, there was no generational wealth. You know, my sister sold the house, and they may have got a few dollars, but they didn't even get enough for a down payment.
Mm.
You know, but a lot of people wanted that ownership in the earlier periods because of the stability. You know, keeping them away from the ravages of these predatory landlords. And so there were lots of other reasons. I mean, my aunt and uncle bought their home in Newark, and they never planned to sell it, never did. I mean, they were a young couple when they bought the house and was standing in there planning on how they would refigure it when they got too old to walk up the steps.
Right.
And I suspect that there are many, many people out there listening who have parents and relatives and friends who had a house that was a cultural artifact. It wasn't a commodity that they were going to sell and make money and buy a bigger house and make money. Some people did that, but not in the classes and the categories that we talk about. So fantasies are great. You know, tell your kids a story about Santa Claus and the Great Pumpkin. But when we get down to the real world, we don't want to hear about the Easter Bunny. We need to look at reality, and then we need to think about how we go about developing our communities, where we place people first, not profits.
And
where we place people first, and their needs, their hopes, and their aspirations.
And to that, inside this project, this demonstration, this neighborhood, rental policies have to be changed.
Yes. Yes. We're entering the age of rent control. We're going back toward the decommodification of housing. And other places in the world have done this, so people should not pull their hair out and scream.
Right.
Vienna, for example, nobody pays more than 12% to 14% of their income on housing. So there are other models out there, and we want to experiment with those types of things. Obviously, we know that the calculus has to work in terms of the care, the maintenance, the upgrades, but there are creative ways to reduce and cut costs. Are we going to be asking our engineers and architects to be imaginative about learning new methods and techniques for developing building materials and the like? And our goal is to get everybody's in our neighborhoods that's renting down to no more than 15 to 20% of their income on housing, which means that they have more income to spend on other commodities, and you get a greater stimulation of the economy that way. Make no mistake, that's a challenge. But as I keep saying, you can't solve a problem that you don't work on.
Right.
And part of a huge challenge that we face, and it's what I mean when I say our greatest challenge is a refusal to face our greatest challenge, is that we won't work on these difficult issues. We won't bring our best minds together and say, how can we make this calculus work? So, for example, if we develop economic strategies based on cooperative economics in a neighborhood and a community, we might be in a community where I would suggest, say, like our demonstration project.
Right.
I would suspect that 75 to 85% of all of the dollars originating in that community flow out without circulating not even one time. An economist will know that if a dollar circulates two or three times, it's creating jobs and other forms of opportunities in that space. So we want to figure out, how do we capture those dollars? One way you capture those dollars is to train the workers who live in the neighborhood and the community to do that work. So if you bring in, say, and I'm making these figures up, $1 million for home repair and the like, and people in the neighborhood are doing 80% of that work, that means that 80% of that $1 million moves in the neighborhood. So the neighborhood gets improved housing as well as increasing the income of their residents. If we start a cooperative grocery store, right, and it's successful, we pass the savings on to the residents. Right? So that now the commodities, the milk, the eggs, the fish, the beef, cost less. And the wages of the workers go up. And these are the types of new era strategies that we're talking about in terms of growing and developing neighborhoods and communities, so that you allow people to rebuild their lives as they rebuild their communities by providing them with the skills to participate. Like, one of the most surprising things that we found, that the neighborhood with the highest unemployment rate among all five of our sites was the place where Northland Training Center is located. Now, Northland is, they're good people.
Right.
So this is not so much a criticism of them, but it's
ironic.
It's an irony.
Yeah.
And to understand, to be unemployed, you must be actively looking for work. If you're unemployed, it means that you are a member of the labor force that cannot find a job. And it means that if you're living in that neighborhood, every day that you go out searching for work, you're walking right past the training center that everybody celebrates as the breakthrough place in the region. Now, again, I want to say Northland is good people. I met with them, et cetera, and they'll be the first one to tell you what they do and what they don't do. So this is not so much about the Northland people, but about the politicians who try to make Northland this silver bullet. And every time we have something good that we should grow and develop, it gets tarnished when the politicians and other folks try to turn it into the silver bullet. Rather than saying, this is progress, we have much, much more work, you know, to do. So what we're saying is that everything we build, every activity we take to renew and fix space is a job. It's an investment. So the question is, who's going to get it? Like, I've been talking about this, and we'll continue to talk about it. $1 billion for the bridge or cap?
Right.
Question, who gets the jobs? Who gets the contracts? Where does the dollar go to sleep at night? Does that billion, how much of that $1 billion will go to sleep on the east side? I don't care where you got your minority worker from. Where did the dollar go to sleep? Did it go to sleep on the east side, or did it go to sleep in Rochester? Did it go to sleep on the east side, or did it go to sleep in Amherst or Clarence? This is the question. Where did the dollar go to sleep? And so when we begin to think, how do we turn the rebuilding of the east side into a job opportunity for the people who live on the east side? We change the nature of the equation, because billions of dollars, even as we talk now, are being spent over there. But the dollars do not go to sleep over there. And so rather than dealing with those issues, the political happy talkers are turning things into silver bullets that aren't silver bullets, when all of they got to do is recognize what the challenges are that we face and then pull people together and say, how can we meet them? How can we meet them?
We're coming down to our final minutes here with Dr. Henry Louis Taylor, Jr. And I think you set me up for the question right there, Dr. Taylor. And that is just that. Right now, the silver bullet is the political talking point. It's been that way for decades. You're talking about some major change here. Is there a spirit in people who want to be in those positions of power? Is it there? Is that spirit there to back and lead the type of change that you are suggesting here in this project?
The spirit is there. The question is, will it grow? I hope that it will. We've got a new alignment of folks that I have some confidence in at all levels of government, including at the congressional level. So we have we're building a new political alignment in this area. And I want to say that we're building a broad-based citywide coalition to go after this one neighborhood. This is just not a little small.
Right. I mean, you can see how people
of this.
Right, you could see other neighborhoods wanting this to succeed because they know that success could finally, the success that they could finally
and
see.
And we have some 18 individuals on our admin team. So it's not just me.
Right.
There's a large body of people who are making choices and those decisions. And the reason that we're doing this, This is not a demonstration project just for the East Side. We're talking about let's change the way we build neighborhoods, but also let's change the way that we build cities. Are there other ways to build vibrant and lively cities that can put people first and can put the quality and standard of life of the residents first while retaining prosperity and continuing to be thriving? And there's a political class that is emerging. I think that in a lot of ways, India Walton's campaign was the rising sun, just peeking over the horizon. It represented the beginning of a new day, a new time. And so we've got lots of young folks and we've got lots of old folks. And we will be contesting for these different political offices and aligning with people who want to deal with specific principles. Like all of our unity around this demonstration project is built around one thing. Do you believe in the values that are in that project? Because we're not changing the values for anybody. Do you believe in this? And people are saying, yeah, then let's happen. And so this is what we're talking about. And I've been pleased with conversations that I've had with folks in the political circle. I've been pleased with conversations and discussions that I've had with people in City Hall. I've been pleased with conversations and discussions that we've had with people in the county. And I believe that this is a new day. But the key is giving folks things that are concrete, well thought out, and doable. I've been even pleased by progressive members of the development community and progressive members of the real estate community. And what that has made me understand, not everybody is against building the just and progressive city. Not everybody is for it, but the numbers of those who want it are much greater, I think, than those who don't. And so our goal, our intent is to continue to build that momentum. My job, well, I'm just a mild-mannered professor, and my task is to do the research.
I'll challenge that mild-mannered description.
And the work, and to encourage and to support the progressive people out there, and to use our center and our abilities to produce knowledge for social change to provide the frameworks that we need to build a better Buffalo. This is our city.
Absolutely.
And we have a right to our city. Our city does not belong to the politicians, to the developers, to the realtors, to the money bags. Our city belongs to the people. And we have a right to our city. And we will work with all of those individuals who want to join with us to continue to grow and develop our city.
Well, you telling me that there are more of those people than those against, it might be the most encouraging thing I've heard on this program in 2 years. Dr. Henry Louis Taylor, Jr., thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure being here.
Dr. Henry Louis Taylor, Jr. of UB's Center for Urban Studies. Coming up next, Alex Simone talks with Buffalo native and University of Maryland professor Jennifer Roberts as they discuss the Kensington Expressway. This is What's Next.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
This is What's Next, and I'm Alex Simone. Humboldt Parkway residents are vocal in expressing concerns about Highway 33. those concerns are part of what drives Buffalo native and University of Maryland professor Jennifer Roberts to keep researching the adverse impact of highways.
How did you know research as far as the Fruit Belt and environmental racism was something that you'd had interest in?
I think it was always there. When I got my formal training in public health, it was focused in environmental health because I just was fascinated with like how things in our environment can really impact our health. And I always looked at things critically, like why do some people have this or why do some people have these things dumped in their backyard versus other people? So there was always an aspect of the inequities of that, the inequities of the environmental burdens we all have to shoulder, because as humans, you know, we always have these anthropogenic sources from our cars, from how we heat our houses. So we all have to burden some of the consequences of that. But I was like, how come some people don't? How come some people's neighborhood like this? And I don't think it was later until I really started to critically kind of look at it from the lens of environmental racism. And when I say later, that was probably like well into me being a professor and really trying to interrogate that, like why we see the things we have today. And then I started to say, well, you know, I kind of got to look back in time, because you just wake up and be like, oh, this neighborhood like just does not have trees, mature trees, because mature trees take 100 years or so, 40 years at least, probably. And so I started to probably really think, and then I started to put up a mirror and look at my own backyard of growing up in Buffalo and saying, hey, wait a minute, this is really relevant to things that happen. Environmental racist aspects happened in even the very neighborhood I grew up in from like age 0 to 8. So I think it was a very organic evolution in terms of how I started to think about aspects of environmental racism. And then also redefining environmental racism, not redefining it so narrowly in the sense that it's not just about people in Flint, Michigan having awful water or people in the Cancer Valley of Louisiana getting exposed to carcinogens from factories. It could be everything from racial profiling. You are in a space and you can't engage in that space safely or pleasantly. So I really think that it's all kinds of stressors. And it's not just the ones that we think about in our air, our water, our food. It's other aspects as well. So I think it was an organic evolution.
You already touched on how you got onto this topic a bit, but can you sort of add in the perspective of how you specifically became interested in investigating the racism of highways? Or it feels almost kind of weird, like personifying a highway, but, you know, like the racism, I guess, that's levied.
I'm in the Department of Kinesiology at the University of
Conduit.
And I created a course a few years ago playing on the phrase zip codes is a better predictor of your health than genetic codes. And so my course is called Zip Codes, Its Prediction of Physical Activity and Health. In creating that course, I had to really delve into aspects of why there were physical activity deserts. And then by looking at physical activity deserts, so meaning there's either not a recreational space, and that doesn't always have to be like a YMCA type of like built environment space, but often a park where people can recreate. And so I started to look at, well, why do certain neighborhoods not have these parks? And then why do certain neighborhoods, if they do have these parks, they're smaller, they're smaller in acreage, lower in quality. Sometimes they are, you know, blanketed with violence. And that's a question where I had to go back and be like, well, how were our neighborhoods designed? So I started to do like a lot of like putting on kind of like this urban planning hat, which is totally not my sandbox. Like I said, my background is environmental health, but I always love jumping into other people's sandboxes and learning new stuff. So I started to just kind of delve into like, well, why are our neighborhoods this way? Like, I kind of knew the answer, but I didn't really know the answers in the sense that, like, actual documentation. So I started to just look at how something as simple as, like, even just the evolution of how neighborhoods were designed from the beginning, of going all the way from, like, the 19th century, how we lived very much in these urban centers, looking at aspects of suburbanization, looking at even later on aspects of more sprawl. Why do people move in certain areas? Why do people feel it's more just a preference of being around certain people? And so I really started to look at kind of almost the catalyst for these waves of movements. So even like if you go all the way back to shortly after Emancipation Proclamation, the majority of Black people still lived in the South. The majority of people in this country lived in the South. So I'm like, how did they get to the cities? So then you start to think, okay, well, why? Well, it wasn't that great in the South. Also, you had opportunities up north. And those opportunities often paralleled with our World War I and World War II. So what happened is you had the factories up north who were like, I'm losing all my workers. All my workers are going to go fight the war. So you have people down south who are like, wow, I can go get a job at, you know, Henry Ford. He's offering like $5 a day, which, you know, at the time was pretty good offerings compared if you're a sharecropper and you're not really getting anything. Also, you know, they have training up in Detroit. I can learn how to build cars. I can have an opportunity. Also, too, the people were like, wait a minute. If we don't all have to be sharecroppers or live in these like really impoverished conditions, my kids can go to school. So you have waves of people going up north. So like that right there is making me think, okay, well, where are these people living? Up north, people were not necessarily having these open arms and having all these waves of Black people come up. So you started to look at how things started to get segregated, you know? And so it made me start thinking, fast forwarding to like, okay, well, over time in urban centers, you had pretty much segregated areas, segregated by what the areas were, whether they were red lines, so therefore Black people are going to live over here versus Black people going to live over here, or they couldn't even go over here where they were like maybe not red line because there's racial covenants on those properties. So I can't even rent or buy the house, even if I could buy the house. So I got to stay over here. And then you had issues with just other discriminatory practices that made it so that I could only live in certain areas. So many cities started to create these kind of enclaves of like, okay, you have foreign-born, you know, white immigrants, maybe had German people, Irish people, because there was definitely a hierarchy with those folks. They weren't as low down on the totem pole as Black folks, but they still were not born as Americans here, like this kind of upper bourgeois echelon. So you had these neighborhoods. And then I started to think, well, why were certain neighborhoods having much more disenfranchisement, much more disinvestment? And it made sense because if I'm a city planner, if I'm a city, I'm going to invest in the neighborhoods that are going to be most profitable in the sense that they're going to have the highest equity homes. So I'm going to make sure they have the trees and the pretty parks where I'm not going to do it in these other neighborhoods. And when you have these other neighborhoods, they're probably impoverished, not necessarily blighted, but they just don't have the same investment. And then you fast forward to where you're like, okay, some of these folks who are like, wait a minute, you guys are getting a little too close to me, coupled with the GI Bill, where, you know, soldiers come back, I can go get like a brand new house in the suburbs. They became even more impoverished in the cities. And so when it came to this interstate highway project, where you had Eisenhower who just went over, he thought the Autobahn was the greatest thing. Like, we need to have highways. This fascinating new phenomenon happened in the United States where you have these highways being built. Because it made sense. You want to get an efficient way to get from the suburb to the city center, because that's still where a lot of the jobs were held. And big construction projects. I mean, highways are big and noisy and cumbersome. So you have to figure out where you're going to put them. Are you going to put them in this beautiful area that you've invested trees and parks and the homes have the highest values? No, I'm not going to put them over there. I'm going to put them over here where it's not so great. You know, the home values are a little bit lower. So you start to see how tools of racial planning, racial practice, just all of that are decided in a racist type of aspect. So yes, the highway is not racist, but the decision to put that highway in certain areas versus another area is the underpinnings of that have a racist ideology.
You looked at a variety of communities, right? You looked at, as you mentioned, Syracuse, Rochester, but is there anything about Buffalo specifically that kind of set it apart from the highway systems and the way everything was laid out in other communities?
There's a lot more similarities than not in the sense of where the highways were decided to be placed. I think what sticks out for me for Buffalo is not only is it my hometown, but it sticks out because you destroy this homestead treasure. I mean, like, this dude is highly regarded, and they call him the father of landscape architecture. Like, that is his name. You go to any landscape architecture class, everyone knows Olmsted. He even, they created an additive. It's a very Olmstedian. Like, and not only did you destroy it, it wasn't like you destroyed one of his little tiny parkways. So the parkways on the west side, Chapin, Bidwell, and Lincoln, they're much smaller. But I know for sure Pummel Parkway was 2 miles long. It was the longest of all three. And it connected the two other parks. It really connected the, I call it like the treasure, almost like the emblem, so to speak, of the whole Emerald Necklace. And so y'all destroyed it. Like, and it's like a destruction where it wasn't like, oh, you know what? The grass is kind of orange and it's not looking good. No, you had to cut down all these trees. I was like, how could that not hurt you? To cut down these real old, beautiful elm and oak trees. So I think that's why it really sticks to me a little bit differently, because you had to really destroy something and destroy a natural beauty that everybody, not just people on the east side, but everybody in the city enjoyed. You had to destroy that before you built this highway. So I think that's what really sticks out for me. I know the issue with Syracuse, it's an elevated highway, so that was a little bit different. Now Rochester's that big old loop. I'm sure there was some destruction there in terms of how to build that whole loop around the city, but I haven't heard of any other place where this treasure, this natural environmental treasure, had to be destroyed to put in the highway, so to speak. So I guess that's why Buffalo sticks out for me.
And from all the stuff you've looked into, does it seem like there's any difference between when a community goes with highway versus something that's more at ground level? Does that make any difference at all?
You mean in terms of the adverse impact on the community?
Yes.
Okay. You know, I really don't think so. I know the elevated Interstate 81 was just as devastating to that community in Syracuse as Interstate 490 in Rochester, because that really, it almost like sequestered, so to speak. And it created this crescent of poverty because it became like an actual moat that you could not cross if you were a certain community. So it almost made it so that those communities, they were so marginalized that they didn't get the same opportunities, resources that were within the circle or within the loop. So I don't think necessarily whether it's elevated or whether it's not elevated or whether it's depressed, like an example in Buffalo, it's depressed. I just think having this structure that just completely bifurcates a community, because that's the key thing, how it bifurcates. It's the separation in terms of you go straight through the community. Or even if you're adjacent, you still have all of these negative aspects of having a highway near your community, because some of the vitality of a community is the businesses, and you cannot have walk-up traffic on a highway. So if you are a business and you're adjacent to the highway, you can't necessarily have walk-up traffic, and highways are loud, highways have air pollution. They're just all these things. They're just tools for people to use their cars. And it's not friendly for pedestrians. It's not friendly for bicyclists. It's just not friendly for so many aspects. And so it can really have these deleterious impacts, residential-wise and business-wise, regardless if it's elevated. And they're noisy. Did I say that? Yeah, they're noisy, because I can't even imagine an elevated highway over your street. It's like a plane going over you all the time. I actually lived near a highway before I moved into this house that was two streets over, and I could still hear it. Like, hear it. And it was actually a beltway. This is the 495. And I could still hear it. It was like cars were going. And you knew at nighttime when it'd be speeding. And it was still very, very loud. And so I think they're just not great things to be living by.
I just kind of had this thought about the sort of time periods in which highways came into popularity. Interestingly, I feel like highways coming into, you know, becoming ideal, or, you know, at least at a national level, the idealized thing, interestingly, kind of mimics the timeline of the shopping mall. It was kind of like the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now they're both falling by the wayside. You know, less and less mm-hmm. shopping malls are being successful. And it feels like more and more highways are being removed.
Yes,
after a long time. Is there anything you think about how those two timelines parallel each other?
You know what? I think that that's a really great observation to see that. I hadn't even thought about the shopping mall part, but you are absolutely right. And I think that's also a generational thing. I asked my friends who's a lot of their kids are either in college or I'm going to say from 18 to in college. And I asked them, like, how many of your kids, like, have license? And they're like, none of them. So even that change of, like, this whole idea, like, when I turned, like, 15 and a half, whenever you, I could get whatever you call it first, not the license.
The permit?
Thank you. I was at DMV, like, when it was opening. But that was, like, my generation. Now generation is like, no, I don't even care to even have a license. I don't even care to be able to drive. I don't want a car. I will Uber everywhere. And I want to live in a place where I can walk everywhere. And so I think there's definitely these parallels in the sense that when we had this whole automania that was coupled with suburbia, and then it got to a point where also cars became more affordable for more people. So now it's like everybody gets these brand new shiny cars. So that was definitely a thing of the 50s and the 60s to get these. And you go on road trips. So all these things were around automania. Like, look, I can just get on the highway and just go. And also, you know, relatedly, you had these like shopping malls. You just, you know, it was no longer where I just had to just have this big, you know, like catalog. I can actually go into this place and find all these different stores. And so I think people are moving away from that or have been moving away. And I've seen actually some towns, I think there was one town in Colorado, there was a whole shopping mall that closed. They converted that to a stop for a light rail line where they have it where people can like ride their bike. And there's a place like a big storage for like store your bike. You could even change your clothes, get on the light rail. Like they made this whole conversion and they showed like how the mall used to be like back in the 80s, like it was a place to be and how like what it looks now. I wish I could remember the name of that city. But in any case, there definitely is a parallel. And you probably can see, if someone mapped like data, like the number of new licenses, you would see a drop. And you would see probably the number of malls closing. You would see an increase. But you would see the change would probably be very equal in terms of, like, not equal, but you could see, like, a parallel in terms of how malls are closing, the reduction of number of license. And even probably you start, now, I think the filling in of highways is a little bit slower because I think people are a little resistant. I think they still feel we need these highways. And it's funny, too, because you could have like half the population. You do not have the vehicular demand that you or burden that you had at one time. But I think people are a little resistant. Some towns are getting more like, OK, but I think some people still think, oh, we need it. We just need it. But yeah, I definitely do see like the relationship and the parallel between that.
And, you know, even when you were talking, when I heard you talking the first time, it got me thinking about without the highways, maybe people stay, like you're saying, as far as suburbia, people stop living in the suburbs quite so much if mm-hmm. there are no highways. So maybe it, you know, helps to bring back the more of the urbanization. But on the flip side, how difficult do you think that line is to maintain between, well, okay, we don't want the highways really, but like don't just come in and gentrify the whole neighborhood, you know, yes. as we've seen in cities across the U.S.
You see people who are now like, oh, I'm so this commute is too much. Because you have some cities where the highways there, like Atlanta, I do not ever still see them filling up their highways because they are so resistant to having any kind of expansive mass transit. So they have to have the highways, like, just there's no other way. But what happens is people eventually get tired in certain areas of like, my commute is like an hour one way. I'm stuck in the car. So I would rather either live in closer, but sometimes you get priced out. You can no longer live closer in the cities because it's too expensive. And then what happens is you might say, okay, so you have some developer who's like, well, you know what? Over here we go again, an area that is, you know, surrounded by low-income families, the land is cheap. I can go and build some condos right here and you can live right here. It won't be as expensive over this part of the city. So you have some people who are like, wait a minute, I can come in here, particularly if there's going to be a light rail line. And so that we call it actually transit-induced gentrification. I've seen that before where they're like, we're going to build this brand new light rail line, and it's going to come and it's going to go from the city or maybe out to, not all the way to the suburbs, but it's going to get you close enough. So it does shorten your commute, and you can just get on this light rail line, or you maybe move in closer to the city because you get this light rail line. And as a result, you got families who've been living there. Now, all of a sudden, their real estate goes up, so you could have business gentrification, displacement, or residential displacement because they can no longer afford their taxes. Also, even if they could, even if they're like, okay, fine, you could have a cultural displacement where you got people coming in and all of a sudden the neighborhood doesn't look like the way it does anymore. And that's one thing that actually, too, we didn't really talk about. But regardless of what happens with Buffalo, I do hope it's a full restoration of Humboldt Parkway. But, and that's a horrible but if it goes the other way and it's a tunnel, there still is the risk of gentrification. There's the risk, especially of cultural gentrification. So even if people can hold on to their homes and still pay their increasing taxes, there's a cultural gentrification. East Side looks like the East Side. Like, you bring anybody to Buffalo, say, close your eyes, we're going to turn over here and be like, is this part of the neighborhood look like this part of the neighborhood? They don't even have to know west from east, north from south. There's definitely different look. And it's different businesses, just different flavors, just some perfect personalities. And you want that to be integral to what, you don't want that to change. You know what I mean? And so I think there's that cultural displacement that is a risk anytime you bring in something new, whether it's a new light rail line or, God forbid, a tunnel or the highway, a new green space on top, anything. And then even with, a full restoration, which is what I'm pushing for, there has to be measures put in place to help prevent that. The community has to be involved in. The only way you can help prevent cultures is you have the community. So you're like, no, we still want this to look like this. We still want these different aspects, these different cultural reminders of what this East Side looks like. And so going back to your original question, yes, when you see people who are like, I don't want to live in the suburbs, or it's getting too much, this commute, you do run that risk of gentrification that occurs in the city. We've seen it in so many cities. Even here close to where I live, D.C., just many aspects of that, we see that happening over and over again.
When it comes to the possibility of a tunnel, does that change the equation at all as far as you think the pollution, like with a highway, I feel like the pollution would be kind of spread across everything. Right. Mm-hmm. With a tunnel, like you had previously touched on, it's really out of the two, the four in the rear end of the tunnel. And you're just funneling everything to those two ends. So like, does that really, concentrate the concerns to specifically the two spots where, all the traffic would be entering and exiting?
Well, throughout the whole expressway, you would still have the tailpipe emissions coming about or being emitted from the cars. But where the tunnel portal ends are, you would have these plumes that would have a higher concentration of these tailpipe emissions. And these plumes can travel. So they would travel in the direction of the tunnel portal ends. And so you have communities who may be, downgrade of these tunnels, who would be more likely impacted because they would have a higher level of concentration from exposure to these plumes being emitted from the portal ends of the tunnel.
So in terms of the people who should be worried, it's not just the people being currently affected. Really, if we're speaking with a vested interest here, there are other communities that should be keenly paying attention and being like, hey, if this changes, we have the potential to be, detrimentally affected as well. We really have a vested interest.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Because, depending on the wind directions of those days, you have these big plumes, not only the wind directions, but also the traffic. So you may have some days of the week, mornings, where you have more traffic, or you have more time in the afternoon, and you couple that with like days that sometimes when there's like more sunshine, sometimes there's more chemical reactions with those actual pollutants that come out. And so you have the whole region within that area that should be looking at this critically and don't have traffic. Like, and traffic meaning like there's not going to be a whole lot of traffic on the 33. But usually with tunnels, there's like a little bit of a stagnation because people have to feed in, you know what I mean? And so there's just other aspects that I actually think about when you're thinking about these impacts of putting in a tunnel that can really exacerbate not only the air pollution, but also the noise pollution.
And I guess the thought of, like, have you seen the tunnel model successfully executed other places? You know, anything that comes to mind?
I actually haven't. I would actually have to go and do some research to find out to see if there has been a successful execution of a tunnel that has been put in. I really haven't seen that. I quite frankly always thought tunnels were not always the best option. I've always thought tunnels should only be used when you have a natural barrier that you just can't get by. Like if there is a tunnel where you have to go through a mountain and you go through that mountain. You can't move the mountain. But just creating tunnels just for the sake of creating tunnels to put kind of what, in my opinion, like this artificial green space on top, because I don't care what anyone says. I don't see how a fully natural environment can grow on top of cement. But in any case, I thought obviously tunnels really should be a necessity when you have a natural barrier, you know, or whether you have to go through water. I used to live in Bay Area, San Francisco, and the BART train went through a tunnel underwater to go from one side of the bay to the other side. I was fascinated. I'm like, I don't know how these people built this, but it did. So when you have a barrier like that, but for the sake of creating a tunnel, and I feel like you're creating this tunnel because yes, we've beyond reached the age of maturation for the Kensington and the retaining walls are getting, like there's, it needs to be done. And so instead of just kind of putting this like band-aid approach, like let's put a tunnel and kind of like pretend we're remedying this age-old historic issue of like taking away the green space from the east side, we'll put some on top. I feel like that's just not the best solution. It makes the situation even worse as opposed to just filling in a highway that we don't even need because it is so underutilized anyway.
And what is it that you think the appeal is to, you know, as far as the tunnel proposal, is it that, well, it makes the problem look better, I guess, you know, it's an aesthetic thing?
Yeah, I think it does make it look better. But I also think when you have people in Buffalo were alive when the parkway was there, so that those people would be like in their 70s and older. So like my mom remembers the Humboldt Parkway. And so you have people who for well over 50 years have been fighting to get something to remedy the misstep that was taken in taking away the parkway and putting in a highway. And this now is the first time ever that people, they actually feel like we're actually going to get something, some kind of remedy. Like this is people have passed away. People have not fighting, but got exhausted from fighting. So now we actually probably have something in their eyes that this is the first thing that could be a remedy and it could look nice with some green space on top. And so I think you have people who are excited because, wow, we're actually going to get this addressed. Not realizing, wait a minute, you are owed so much more and the state and the federal government can do so much better in terms of addressing this issue. You don't have to take this first option. I know you've been waiting decades. We've all been waiting decades to have some kind of remedy, something to address the situation. But you know what? They can do better. And so I think that's why it's an appeal, because it's like the first time. Imagine this is not a good analogy, but I'm going to say if you've been waiting years and years to finally get something to eat and somebody brings you like a Ritz cracker and you're like, oh, okay, I'll take it. I'm so hungry. I'll take it. Not realizing, you know what? You actually can go get like a whole entree. Like that is an option. And actually the entree might be cheaper than you getting the Ritz cracker. Okay, that, like I said, the analogy is not that great. But anyhow, you kind of get the idea of what I'm trying to say in the sense that, you know, you can get something so much better. So that's why I think there's the appeal, because people are just so wanting of something to be done.
Roberts says she works closely with many people in the Humboldt Parkway area, but she would like to increase relations with the Fruit Belt residents specifically. For WBFO News, I'm Alex Simone.